Director of the Office of Church and Society for the American Lutheran Church, based in Minneapolis. That's where I live and work. And one of the things that our office does is help with the social study, social analysis, and social policy development for our denomination. And one of the issues that we've worked on quite a bit over the past years, decade or more, is the issue of justice in Southern Africa, Namibia and South Africa. So what we're going to be talking about today is one aspect of that Southern Africa scene, the question of Namibia. Namibia, I have suggested in the topic or title for this hour, is a special case. And I really think that's true. There are many things special about Namibia. One could almost use the word unique. I've suggested in the outline here that there are three special elements about Namibia, and that will form the outline for the presentation. What is special about Namibia? Well, it's special as a case in international law. It really is one of a kind. There is no other like it in international law. Secondly, it's special as an example of the endurance and the faith and the hope of its people, particularly its Christian people, who are the great bulk of the people of Namibia. I think it's 85%, Ed, of the population is Christian, something in that range. And thirdly, it's special as a challenge to the global community, and particularly the global church community. And I want to talk some about that in our concluding segment. Namibia, as a bit of global geography, is roughly the size, almost exactly, in fact, the size of two Californias. If you took California and then doubled it over into Nevada, another California, Namibia is two Californias. It's a lot of area. It's a lot of territory. But if you had two Californias, you'd have, what, about 42 million people. I think California is currently 21 or 21 plus million people. Namibia does not have 42 million people. Namibia has about 1 million people. So Namibia's territory is roughly 1/40th as populated as California. I think that is probably because of the climate and the fact that the land cannot sustain a large population because it's simply an arid or semi-arid region. But Namibia is underpopulated, and it's resource-rich. It's a very desirable territory in terms of economic exploitation because it has a lot of wealth, natural wealth. It has diamonds, it has gold, it has copper, it has a lot of natural beauty, it has large areas set aside as natural parks. Namibia has been desirable, not necessarily as a place for large numbers of people to live, but as a place to exploit for over 100 years. And Europeans discovered that fairly late. It's one of the latest parts of the African continent to be settled or claimed by Europeans. The Germans got into the business late of colonizing Africa. And one of the areas that was left when the Germans arrived or came into the colonizing business was Southwest Africa, what is now usually called Namibia, which is the name that the people of Namibia prefer. But in European colonization vocabulary, it's Southwest Africa. Yeah. This is a map of Namibia itself, but you probably can't see it. On the map of Africa, it is this area right here. South Africa being down here at the tip, at the cape. Southwest and West Africa to the west and north of it. On this map, the road map of South Africa, this is South Africa. Namibia begins here and goes up off the map.
Chuck, since this is my map, I'll use magic marker.
All right. Ed contributed this map so he can mark it up. That'll help. I think Namibia, or Southwest Africa for that matter, were largely unknown to the world community for a long, long time. Nobody paid much attention to that region until rather recently, and even today there are people who don't know where Namibia is. So the geography of it is rather important. It's on that South Atlantic coast, almost down to the Cape, but not quite, because the Cape area is part of South Africa. Angola is just north of Namibia. Immediately north of Namibia is Angola. And that's important for the politics of the region right now, and we'll return to that. Well, first way in which Namibia is special. It's special as a case in international law. This requires some review now of the history of the territory since the Europeans arrived. It was, as I said, originally a German colony named Southwest Africa. Informally, German presence began with the arrival of missionaries. In this case, it wasn't first the colonizers or the government types who came in and staked a claim. It was the missionaries. It wasn't even the economic interests like the British East India Company or the Hudson Bay Company or that kind of thing. It was missionaries who came first. In the 1840s, the Rhenish Mission Society of Germany, that's of the Rhineland, Ed, isn't it? The Rhenish of the Rhineland sent Lutheran missionaries to Namibia. At about the same time, some German settlers began to come in and some German economic interests began to explore. They discovered diamonds early on, I think in the 1870s, and that attracted additional German settlers. Formally, the Germans claimed Namibia in 1884. So it's just a little over a century ago. That was under Bismarck. And they said, this is now German territory, it's a German colony. And they encouraged European settlers to come, as it was one of the places in German-controlled Africa that seemed suitable for white settlement or European settlement. Other German colonies, just to remind you, were Tanganyika, present-day Tanzania, and part of Cameroon, and Togo. The first commissioner of Namibia sent by Bismarck was H.E. Gehring. Does that name strike a familiar note in your mind? The son of H.E. Gehring, raised in Southwest Africa, was Hermann Gehring, the Nazi leader of World War II. There is, I'm told, Ed, maybe you can confirm it, a street in Windhoek called Gehringstrasse. Is that true? Windhoek is the capital of Namibia. And there is still a lot of German flavor there. In fact, I've not been there, but the pictures you see, Ed has been there. It looks like the churches there look like, the Lutheran Cathedral particularly, looks like a turn of the century German church, which is what it is. So there's a lot of German flavor in Windhoek, and there's still a fairly sizable German community there in the middle part of the country, around the capital, and in some of the agricultural area in the central part of Namibia. The white population of Namibia today is about 100,000, much of it of German origin, German descent. But some of those people have been there for two, three, four generations now. The Germans ruled with a rather strong arm. A force of arms was a part of their policy. In the early 20th century, there was a revolt among the Herero population of Namibia. And there was a massacre of those people by German military power, and the report is that they went from 80,000 to 15,000 people. The others were simply wiped out between 1904 and 1907. So the German rule of Southwest Africa, which was short, from 1884 to 1915, because in 1915, Germany was preoccupied with World War I in Europe, the South Africans moved in and effectively took control of the territory. So German presence there was only about 40 years in terms of administration, but the German rule of Southwest Africa is not remembered fondly by the people. After World War I, the League of Nations gave the administration of Namibia, or Southwest Africa, to South Africa as a trust. You may recall that the League of Nations did that with other colonies in Africa and other parts of the world which had been controlled by the losing side. The Germans lost control of part of New Guinea in the same way, and that was given as a trust to Australia. And a lot of these areas are areas where there are strong Lutheran churches today. Why? Because there was a German presence there at one time, and the missionaries tended to follow the flag. You have strong Anglican churches where the British colonies were. Well, the mandate given to South Africa legally in 1920, the administration of this territory was turned over to South Africa, and South Africa was asked to pursue the well-being and the development of the people and to prepare the territory for self-government. That was fairly general. All of the League of Nations mandates and after World War II, the UN mandates to trust territories called for not exploitation by the mandate holder, but preparation of the people for self-government and the well-being and development of the people. Well, instead, South Africa set up a government for whites only and provided economic development in white areas only. There was a line drawn across the territory in those years, and the blacks were supposed to live north of that line and the whites in the central and southern part. Well, blacks didn't all live north of that line, but the blacks who were in the southern part tended to be the workers for the whites and had no rights, economic or political. South Africa in 1920, I'm now jumping to World War II. Let me finish on after World War I. South Africa set up government for whites only and provided economic development only in white areas. After World War II, the League of Nations responsibilities became the UN responsibilities under international law. And so the mandate continued. In the late 40s, South Africa asked the UN for permission to incorporate Namibia into South Africa proper as a part of South Africa. That was denied by the United Nations. But the South African government continued to rule Namibia almost as though it were a fifth province. The Republic of South Africa, what was formerly the Union of South Africa, includes four states: Cape, Orange Free State, Transvaal, and Natal. And that continues today. South Africa, in effect, treated Namibia as a fifth state of South Africa. The whites of Namibia were given virtual autonomy in running the territory. At a certain point, they were even given seats in the South African Parliament. The whites were. The apartheid practices of South Africa were introduced more and more in the years after World War II, especially after 1948, when the National Party, the present ruling party of South Africa, took over and formally and legally introduced apartheid, which is still the case in South Africa today. There had always been apartheid of a kind, that is, racism of a kind in policy, in culture, in Southwest Africa, but it was not written into law until after World War II, when South Africa began to introduce it. In 1949, now we're going to come quickly down to the present. 1949, the Namibians first petitioned the UN formally for an end to South African rule. Nothing happened. In 1966, the UN got around to formally declaring the mandate to be over. The UN said, we're now taking back what we have entrusted to South Africa. It's now back under the control of the United Nations, under international legal authority. Well, South Africa ignored that. And because the UN has very little effective way of enforcing its rulings, it has never been enforced. But legally, the mandate was ended in 1966, almost 20 years ago now. In 1967, the UN established a council for Namibia, which still exists and whose charge is to work for and to prepare for the independence of Namibia. In 1971, the UN and other countries of the world took the case of Namibia to the International Court of Justice in The Hague. The International Court of Justice, another body which can make rulings but has no power to enforce them. It doesn't even have power to enforce governments to participate in its decision-making, as is illustrated currently by the U.S. withdrawal from Court of Justice decisions on the mining of the harbors in Nicaragua. Well, in 1971, the Court of Justice ruled that the UN does have the legal authority to end the South African trusteeship in Namibia. That same year, there was sent an open letter from the Lutheran leaders in Namibia to Prime Minister Voerster of South Africa, a very courageous letter because of the intensity of the appeal that they made and the strength of it's a rather dramatic statement. Later then, Bishop Owala of Namibia, of the Northern Church up along the Angolan border, which is called Ovamboland, he and other Lutheran leaders of Namibia went to talk with Prime Minister Voerster about making their plea for freedom for Namibia. Well, the Court of Justice decision in 71 says that under international law, and it's recognized, I think, by every country in the world except South Africa, this decision is, South Africa has no legal right to be there. But South Africa is still there. In 1976, the Security Council Resolution 435, which you'll still hear about because that's still the operating UN piece of legislation governing Namibia, it called for elections under UN supervision at the earliest possible date. There was a deadline set for South African acceptance of that resolution. South Africa refused to accept the resolution. The deadline passed, and then the Western powers, led by the United States but joined by other Western countries, the United Kingdom, Canada, Germany, I think Japan and France as well, the Western powers together agreed that they would not support veto, or would not support sanctions against South Africa. The Security Council moved for economic sanctions against South Africa, which the UN resolution had called for if South Africa didn't comply. But then we and the other Western powers that were present in the Security Council vetoed those sanctions. So we have supported, as a government, UN Resolution 435. That is still the policy of the US government, including the Reagan administration, to seek the independence of Namibia under UN Resolution 435. But we have not supported the further implementation of that resolution, which calls for sanctions. Also in 1976, the UN created the Institute for Namibia. That is a program for training and preparing the Namibian people for independence, training civil servants. There is a center in Lusaka, Zambia, up to the north of Botswana and Rhodesia, or Zimbabwe, a center for training people so that they will be prepared to run the country. It is the first time in the history of decolonization that the international community has moved in that way to prepare a people for nationhood. And you and I, in a small way, contribute to that through our tax dollars, because some of our tax dollars, very little, but some, go to the costs of the Institute for Namibia. That's another way in which Namibia is unique. And some of this, of course, is happening because the territory has been a UN trust territory. It's been a UN responsibility. Some of it has happened because of the long time lag. Namibia is the last colony on the African continent. It is the last area that doesn't have self-government by the majority of its people. Well, in 1977, South Africa did not respond to UN 435. Nobody was minded to send in troops, international troops under the UN or anybody else's troops. And so effectively, South Africa continued to maintain control. In 1977, the so-called five Western powers took an initiative. That was under the Carter administration. It included, in addition to the US, the United Kingdom, France, West Germany, and Canada. And they said, we will break the logjam. We will begin and call for negotiations directly with South Africa and, for the first time, with SWAPO. SWAPO is the Southwest Africa People's Organization, which was formed in the early 60s as, at first, a nonviolent force for freedom and independence in Namibia. In the 70s, they turned to take up arms, and they still have arms as part of their strategy. One of their strategies is military strategy. Well, SWAPO was included in the negotiations. The UN recognizes SWAPO as the legal representative of the Namibian people. South Africa has never recognized SWAPO. But because of the initiative in 1977 of the five Western powers, South Africa agreed to come to the negotiating table with SWAPO, the five Western powers, and itself. Those talks went on for about 3 years. They ended in early 1981, January of 81, just as the Carter administration was leaving office and just before Reagan's inauguration. South Africa walked out of the talks. The Namibia talks ended. They have not been reconvened. The policy of constructive engagement by our government toward South Africa was announced, and that continues to be our policy. And some, the cynics have called it a policy of all carrot and no stick. It's a policy of treating South Africa very gently and trying to get what continues to be the stated goal of the United States government, freedom for Namibia, as well as resolution of some other problems within South Africa, leading to participation by all of the people there in their own government. But the policy has, I think most observers would say, been totally ineffective. It hasn't accomplished anything except to give South Africa four more years. of rule in Namibia. In 1985, this year, South Africa is again seeking to set up its own puppet government in Namibia. They tried that back in the mid-70s. It was not recognized by anybody else in the world. Now they are about that again. Not only the whites, but the blacks who are willing to be collaborators with the South African government. Okay, second way in which Namibia is special, I think, is the role of the churches. I said already that the Rhenish Mission came in 1842. They worked primarily in the middle part of the country, in through here, where the capital Windhoek is, and in that region. In 1874, the Finns came into Ovamboland. Ovamboland is the strip up along the border, which is quite populated, up along the border with Angola. In fact, some of the Ovambo people live on the Angola side. The Finns worked there for 9 years before the first baptism, which came in 1883. In 1983, they had a special observance of that first baptism on Epiphany, 1983, January 6th, and they had church leaders from all around the world come in, and I remember that Bishop Crumley and Bishop Preuss from the U.S. were among that company. These two churches, the Ovambo Kavango Church in the north and the ELC, Evangelical Lutheran Church of Southwest Africa in the middle part of the country, have been independent since the late 50s. They have moved increasingly toward being one church, working more and more together. They're moving toward full unity. They have a united seminary and have had for how many years, Ed? You visited there. Paulinum Seminary has been... Paulinum. Paul Seminary. They've had a United Seminary for some decades, I think, a couple decades at least. These two churches together have become very vibrant churches, very strong in the institutions they've developed for social service, for education. In fact, many have said that the church in Namibia really provides the social services for the country, because the South African government has not done it, particularly for the blacks. So education, the best high school in the country, the most prestigious high school, is a high school of the Lutheran Church. They have about 520,000 members now, and they are still growing, although the growth has slowed down because nearly everybody in Namibia is now a church member. Much of the country's leadership has been provided by and even trained by the churches through their schools. Much of the leadership of SWAPO, the Southwest Africa People's Organization, which South Africa calls a terrorist organization, is Lutheran people. The Lutheran Church of Namibia says those are our sons and daughters who are carrying those guns. The white church in Namibia, there's a small German background church of about 15,000 members, primarily around Windhoek and in the agricultural farm country nearby, has been very troubled on the unity question. Now, these are people who've been, remember, in Namibia for two, three, or four generations. Their families have been. They consider themselves to be Namibians as well. They are like some of the whites in Zimbabwe who were long-time residents of that country and citizens of that country. And I believe many of them intend to stay after independence and want to be part of a united black-majority Namibia. Some may leave. I think it depends on how the transition occurs and how much bloodshed is associated with it. But the white church has been very troubled on the question of unity. Some of the white leadership, clergy particularly, and some of the white laity, have been willing to work together with the large black churches in Namibia. Others have not. They want to stay an apartheid, separated church. This white church is one of the, its name is interesting, it's the DELK, the Deutsche Evangelische Lutherische Kirche. That's still its name, it's still got the German name. Some of the DELK people have been very troubled by the fact that their church has not been more unified with the blacks, and yet the majority of the white church has always given trouble to pastoral leadership in particular, which presses for unity. So that pastors who come still mostly from Germany, The German Lutherans send pastors down to the Namibian white church to serve them. If they become too outspoken, they're sent home. And then they're replaced by others. And so there's been a kind of rotating, circulating, revolving door of pastoral leadership in that white church. That white church was one of the two churches which was suspended from the Lutheran World Federation at its meeting last summer. Over a 14-year period, the World Lutheran Community through the LWF debated the question of what to do about the lack of unity between whites and blacks in Southern Africa, where they are both whites and blacks are member churches of the Lutheran World Federation, and yet back at home they cannot go to each other's altars for communion. And that's been a particular problem in South Africa, less so in Namibia, but still some of it in Namibia. And the politics and the history of separation of races of the territory has been imposed on the churches as well. Well, the white church in Namibia was suspended. That doesn't mean it's been kicked out of the family of World Lutheranism. It means it doesn't have any right to vote until progress is made on two points: a condemnation of apartheid and real significant steps toward unity with the blacks. The blacks have always been open to it, and I suppose you could say from the white perspective, well, it's easy for them to be open to unity because they would swallow up the whites numerically. That's true. However, the whites have a lot of the economic power within the Lutheran community in Namibia, and I think there's more hope, really, about eventual reconciliation between the white and black churches in Namibia than there is in South Africa. That's the sense I get from reporters who watch that scene. But that continues to be an issue. They are now talking to each other, at least you can say that, about how they can move toward one church. The two black churches are not yet fully united either, but they've been in separate parts of the territory geographically, and there is not an issue between them of a doctrinal or racial character. The other churches in Namibia that are fairly sizable, relatively speaking, remember we're talking about a total population of only 1 million people, the Roman Catholics, the Anglicans, and the U.S. American Methodist Episcopal Church, one of our black Methodist denominations, has been active in Namibia. And those churches and some other smaller ones came together in 1978 and formed the Council of Churches of Namibia. The Council of Churches of Namibia called as its first executive director Abisai Shayavali. Some of you have met him or heard of him. He studied for several years in Dubuque. He was enrolled at Wartburg Seminary, but he actually got a doctorate, I think, through Aquinas. It was one of those joint programs in the Dubuque, Iowa, seminary consortium where you can earn a doctor's degree. He completed that work and went back to Namibia and became the first executive of the Council of Churches in Namibia. It is, by all measure, the most effective opposition voice within the country, opposition to the South African government and its apartheid policies. It's been a very courageous voice, speaking out repeatedly whenever the need seemed to be there. Now, the churches in Namibia have endured a lot of suffering because of the continuing struggle.
And they have regular, and the military of South Africa occupies the country. The South Africa Defense Force is there. I think I read once with 100,000, which would be one for every 10 Namibians. It's a massive force, a massive presence. Worship is regularly disrupted. On the argument that they're looking for terrorists who are being sheltered in the church, the South African Defense Force comes in and interrupts worship and takes people out and frisks them. There have been bombings regularly, bombings of the church publishing house in the north. After the third one of those, because the church's press is quite outspoken about the politics of the country and the need for independence and justice, after one of the recent bombings, a South African administrative official said, well, if you don't want your press bombed, stay out of politics. The church's leaders have been detained. Some have been mysteriously killed. Recently, the South African administration of the country, of the territory, said no more travel to the north without permission, which is a way effectively to limit, not only within the country internally, but visiting groups from going to the north. There was quite a bit of that happening. Both the ALC and the LCA have sponsored mission study trips to Namibia, and they had gone to the north. Well, now they can't unless they get permission to travel from the South African administration of the country. Courageous and outspoken voices from Namibia. The bishop in the north for many years, who died recently, the one who really took the lead in sending the open letter to Prime Minister Voerster, Leonard Awala, A-U-A-L-A, through the 60s and 70s. The present bishop in the north is Bishop Dumeni. The leader of the church in the south is Precis, or President Frederick. Both have provided, and those churches previously have provided, a lot of leadership in the global Lutheran family. Bishop Dumeni currently is a member of the executive committee of the LWF, one of the 30 members of that body. Pastor Kamita, whom I mentioned earlier, was here in this country, numerous times, but he was here most recently last fall for the Light Conference at Holden. He's been an especially effective and poetic, outspoken leader of the church. His picture appears in this book, Abounding in Hope, in the chapter that deals with the suspension of the white churches in southern Africa, on page 90. And I'll send this around. It's a very interesting picture, almost a historically symbolic picture, because it pictures three black and two white leaders of the churches in South Africa and Namibia at a press conference where they were talking about what the meaning of the suspension action is. And you can read their names and their affiliations under the picture. I think they have been a powerful witness to the rest of the global family of Christians and Lutherans. People, and Ed can tell you more about this because he has recently been there, I have not, a people who have witnessed to us out of their suffering with a strong conviction that there is still hope. They are still a hopeful people, a joyous people, really a remarkable people. Out of their political oppression, which they have endured and which they feel is totally unjustified, and they know that most of the world community agrees with them on that, they have a strong measure of courage. They have also, I think, in a remarkable way for Lutherans in particular, united politics and faith. They do not see the distinction between the two, which we often continue to make in the North. They aren't all wrapped up in a two kingdoms kind of approach to the world. They have united those two in a very rich and biblical way. They have also struggled on the side of both the blacks and the whites to unite the Lutherans in that country as they struggle for an independent Namibia. They have the two struggles going on simultaneously. And chapter 5 in this book, Abounding in Hope, talks about that struggle and the meaning of it for the world Lutheran family especially. The church in Namibia has sent missionaries to other parts of the world. It has missionaries in Angola, across the border, where there are some Ovambo people, and it has missionaries now in Senegal. They have chaplaincies in Swapo, refugee camps of Swapo in Angola and Zambia, and they have chaplains working with the soldiers of Swapo. Now, finally, and at less length, let me say something about the challenge which Namibia represents to the world community. The Lutherans in Europe and North America especially have heard the cry for solidarity from the people of Namibia. I think it's akin to the way in which the Roman Catholics of this country identify with the struggle in Central America, because there are large numbers of Roman Catholics there. Or the way the U.S. Jewish community has made a special cause out of the struggle for Israel to remain secure. I think it's akin to that. And some of our leaders in this country have said the Lutherans in this country, without being particularly chauvinistic, need to make a special case with our government and with our economic power, our corporations, of freedom for Namibia, because if we don't, nobody else will. And I think there's some truth in that. That's one of the pluses of using the family of faith globally, and the Namibian people certainly have seen that and have appealed to their brothers and sisters in Western Europe and North America. Well, what is being done? The Lutheran World Federation has had a listening post and an advocacy post at the UN since 1973. That's done through the U.S. Committee for LWF, which is now called Lutheran World Ministries. Some of you know of that effort. Ed May was director of that program for 11 years. He recently retired, a pastor of the AELC. It is now directed by a layman from the LCA, Ralston Deffenbaugh, who is a lawyer and who has special legal experience with Namibia because he has been down there for some of the trials in Namibia. There have been formal statements of support for Namibian freedom, support endorsement of the UN approach to freedom for Namibia from our church body. There have been visits by church leaders in the U.S. to the U.S. government, to the South African government, and to Namibian Christians, of course. There has been prayer in our parishes on a fairly regular and ongoing basis for at least a decade. There has been lobbying by our citizens with their own members of Congress for support by our government of independence for Namibia. There have been visits here by Namibian people and to Namibia by us. And then there has been increasingly support for economic pressure on South Africa. And at that point, I will pass out to you copies of a recent summary statement of the American Lutheran Church, Goals for Combating Apartheid, which includes both South Africa and Namibia. But rather than read it to you or work through it with you as a group, I will just give you copies of it, and you may want to lift up questions about particular aspects of it as you glance through it. I think there is enough for everyone, but perhaps a couple would take only one. It would stretch farther. Now, I would like, we have until, we have about another 22 minutes. I would like to invite Ed Schrader to say any words of elaboration or of correction or of further fleshing out of things I've made, particularly about the Namibian people and the Namibian church and the country, since he was there less than a year ago, wasn't it, Ed? Less than half a year ago. Would you take a few minutes to do that and share some things, saving some time for discussion with the folks? You want to use the mic? Oh, that's called the Katsivi Strip, and that's a strip which goes between Botswana to the south and Angola and Zambia to the north, and lets Namibia connect all the way over to Zimbabwe, former Rhodesia, which is the location here of Victoria Falls. Very prominent natural phenomenon in Africa. It lets Namibia border on many, many countries. And I don't know historically how that happened, but it's a thin strip of where the Kabongo people are, and so there are Lutheran churches all through that strip. Yes? I'll tell you how that happened. That's not the most important thing. And then I'll just mention two focus on two items from my 1 week only in Namibia, just 5 months ago. Namibia was Southwest Africa, the German colony. Over here was Tanganyika, German East Africa. Between that was British colonial territory. Kaiser Wilhelm and Queen Victoria were cousins. So it was family affair. And he wanted Billy to have a connection between his colony here and his colony here, and so they just carved the Katsivi Strip so that from here to get to what was then Rhodesia, and Rhodesia borders on Tanganyika, and they could travel from east to west Africa, the German Strip. Another funny related to that is one of the first African Lutherans I ever met was an artist from just on this bank of Kilimanjaro, which is in Tanganyika, now Tanzania. And he said, you know, I became a Lutheran by the accident of something that happened in the German and the British houses of diplomatic house. Once more, it was Cousin Billy's birthday in about 1890 or so, and Queen Victoria said, she didn't speak German. What should I give Billy for a birthday present? And her counselor said, no, you have mounted in Kenya, in our army there. because that then became German mission territory. Those two little anecdotes are reflective of how much of the history of Africa up until just our generation was really written in the courts of Europe.
And
the borders were all drawn in Europe with no awareness in most cases and no attention to the natural divisions of and locations of people. So for example, the Abambos, half of them up here in Angola, not because they blessed here to go to Angola, but they always were here. And once within Europe, they drew the line and said, right up here across here is going to be Portugal stuff and down here is going to be Germany stuff. Two items about my visit to Namibia. I was both at Windhoek and with this many Windhoek there, the people that Chuck was telling me about, and then I also got out the other day to the seminary out in the bush here, 200 kilometers, at Old City Bingwa, where one of my own graduate students did a master's degree under me as a professor, was a professor, because 2 weeks before I got there, he was killed in an automobile accident. And at first, you know, I thought, hanky-panky, foul play. And technically that wasn't true, but indirectly, he died because of apartheid. When I got there, this was January, well, it was over New Year's weekend, so it was a couple days in December and a couple days in January. The students were on vacation, but the end of December is high summer there. It was 104 degrees. And that's how hot it was when this anniversary took place 2 years ago, when the Americans went over there for, in all their vestments, cook them, serve them, right. Here's what happened. My friend Elian Nkembua and my former student, professor of, I guess he taught systematology, is a diabetic, like I am, and every month he would go back to Windhoek for a medical checkup. He has no car. Nobody could come and have a car except the president. And then he's got a Mercedes of all things. And there's no train or public bus connection, so he'd hitchhike the 60 kilometers down Ocean Bingo up here, so you can see the main highway. And there's a railroad that you can take in the window. He came back from one of those checkups to Beach, which is the last station on the railroad, and then waited for a hitchhike ride down to Ocimbingwa, 60 kilometers. A merchant from Ocimbingwa had sent his son with a van up there to get some supplies to stock the store. These are black people. And Elia knows this guy, and they met him in the street. He said, sure, I'll give you a ride. And so they're driving back to Ocimbingwa, and the left front tire of the van blows. Brand new Toyota. I saw the wreck. And it rolls 3 times. Out in this rocky desert place, Aaliyah gets thrown out on the third roll over, and there's somebody else in the van besides the driver, Aaliyah and him. And so there's 3 people injured, Aaliyah injured the worst. It's 104 degrees, there's no shade. And the first person to come down along the road after a while, and nobody knew exactly how long it was the white South African commissioner of Ocimbingwa, the only white man in town, but he's the governmental commissioner. And the seminary president said, I think he was a bit tipsy, because I wouldn't have expected him to do this to get some others happen. He stopped, surveys the scene, picks up the produce that had been in the van, puts it in his car, drives back to Ocimbingwa, and then from there sends an ambulance back, and an ambulance is a pickup truck, just two people who just had first aid training, in the van, pickup truck, to pick up the injured and then to take them on back to Cutterbeef to the hospital. Well, Elia lay out in 140 degree sun for 4 hours, broken pelvis and internal bleeding. Now, he didn't die yet. At the hospital, he was still alive and they started treating him, but they saw that he was much too serious for them to handle at this sort of bush hospital, and so they helicoptered him to Windhoek, the capital, where, however, he got deposited in the black hospital, not the white hospital, and there's a difference in medical facilities there, and the day later he died. Now, none of my friends, you know, were inside in all these hospital situations, but they just said if he'd been white, he'd be alive, but he's now dead. and he left a widow and 9 kids. And some of us in St. Louis, with whom he became very good friends at the Seminex community and other congregations, are working at least some kind of monetary support for Ra'una Nyakembua and their 9 kids. And the folks there are, the Obombo Christians are themselves rallying around. But that's just one sample of a kind of a, you know, indirect apartheid tragedy. The other thing is, one of the things that makes unity amongst the Lutherans difficult is not just the big geographical separation and the kind of, you know, internecine things. They're not perfect either. They have the same kind of church squabbles as we do, although I didn't hear much about that, is the language problem. Here, Obombo is the language. Here is Herero the language. Here, Nama is the language. When I was at the seminary there, every worship service, not at the seminary, but in the town church, every worship service would obviously be preaching only one language, but there would always be an interpreter who would be translating into at least one more language of the 3, 4, or 5 languages. Once I even heard a sermon preached by a black man in Afrikaans, and then that was translated into Nama. And once I even heard them preach in English, and that was then translated into Herero. But at least every service gets done in 2 languages so that at least most of the folks in the congregation can understand. Because here at this sort of Lutheran seminary and center, there's a mixture. And it, since it's also kind of right in the middle of things, there's Nama folks, there's Herero folks, there's Obombo folks there. Okay, just 2 little vignettes of my visit there. Thank you, Ed. That was Ed Schrader of St. Louis, who visited Namibia and South Africa, Ed, right, in December, January of this past year. One more thing on language. The language of the country of Namibia, when it is free, is to be English. They have decided that will be their common language. They refuse to use Afrikaans, because that's the language of the oppressor. That's the language identified with the South African government. The German-speaking white people in Namibia don't all know English. And so you've got 2 European languages, German and English, plus Afrikaans from South Africa, plus all of the tribal languages. They laugh there. I think they have a good sense of humor about their ethnic differences. The first Namibian church leader I met was Bishop Leonard Owala, who came to Minneapolis sometime back in about 1974, and Bob Vogel, now the president of Wartburg College, had him in his home, him and his wife, with some others who were invited in to meet the Owalas for an evening. And Owala introduced himself to us as a Black Finn, because his people became Christians through the work of Finns in Ovamboland. So that's how they refer to themselves, as Black Finns. And some of those people know Finnish, too. What is the state of disinvestment, and particularly with regard to the Lutheran churches? That is a big subject. We could do an hour on that in itself, if not more than an hour. But let me try to summarize where we are and to some degree where the movement is. As you know, there is a major movement now in the U.S., somewhat less so in Western Europe, but I think in this country it has become a very big thing. It has entered the front pages of our newspapers in the last year or so. But it's really been going on for about a decade. And much of the early leadership of it came from within the church community in this country to bring pressure on South Africa, economic pressure, by withdrawing investments, foreign investment from South Africa. That is, the goal has been to get U.S. and presumably other foreign investors in South Africa to leave the country. There is a lot of foreign investment there. The U.S. is not by any means the largest foreign investor, our companies. The largest is the United Kingdom, and second is Germany, and we're third. We're a close third now. But Japan is there and moving up, and others are there as well. There's a debate about whether that's good strategy, first of all. Those who believe it's good strategy say the way to bring pressure on our companies to leave is for us to leave, the company. That is, to pull our investments out, whether we're a university endowment fund or a state or local government, investment of employee pension funds, or a church, or a foundation, or whoever. And the disinvestment or divestment movement has been active in all of those areas. One of the first church bodies, major church bodies in the United States, to take a divestment action, and it's a modified divestment action, I have to make very clear, one of the first to take any kind of divestment action was the American Lutheran Church in 1980. That action is quoted in a document, which I don't have copies of, but I have a copy if any of you want to look at it. It was a request to the Board of Trustees of the ALC, which has the legal final authority regarding investment. And that's not just ALC law, that's state law, under the law of the state of Minnesota. The legal authority is with the Board of Trustees. The convention requested the board to move toward divestment of all of our holdings from companies operating in South Africa in a prudent manner and without undue risk. That was part of the action. That's very important language, because that was a way of guarding against the possibility of a lawsuit, which, if we simply said divest without regard to prudency, then the Board of Trustees could be sued by any member of the pension plan. Pension money is different from any other kind of investment money in that pension money is held as a trust for those whose money it really is, the employees and future retirees and present retirees of the church. It's their money being managed for them by the church Board of Trustees in our case. And so the convention recognized that had to be stated carefully, and it could not be a directive to the board. In any case, it could be a request. Well, the board responded in March of 81 by saying, our policy will be to, when there is a choice between two securities of which promise equal return for the pension plan members, to opt for the security that is not in South Africa, that is not in a company that's in South Africa. The Board of Trustees has moved toward that eventual goal of total divestment, which I think the convention clearly wished, but has not moved fast enough for some. Those who think we should be totally clean are not happy, because I think we're now at about, we were in 27 companies as of the fall of 1980. That is, pension money was in 27 companies that are in South Africa. I think it's now down to 8. As a percentage of the total holdings, total stock holdings, it has gone from 32% to, I think the figure is something like 7 or 8%. But we're still in some companies. We're out of Control Data, we're in 3M. We're out of Xerox, we're in Bristol-Myers, I guess. So we're not completely clean, and so the debate continues. The debate also continues about whether it's an effective strategy anyway. I think divestment accomplishes two things, no matter what else you say about it. I do not claim it will bring about a change in the apartheid system in South Africa by itself. I do not even believe it'll, in itself, force the companies to leave. But I think it will accomplish two things. It will make sure that we, as a church body, and those of us who are members of its pension plan, will not have any of our retirement earnings coming from the apartheid economy. I mean, we can say that's important to us, that none of my retirement benefits are benefiting from the apartheid system, because they're not invested. If it were true that we were completely out, we could say they are not invested there. The second thing it accomplishes, it seems to me, is to make a very strong public witness, if we, in fact, publicize the fact that we are divested. And it seems to me that's the most important thing that South Africa fears right now. It's really a warfare that's going on globally about symbols.